Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Megan Opria. She is senior contributor at The Federalist and editor of Inbound, a daily foreign affairs news and insight journal. Meg, I want to find out what you think about Donald Trump's strike in retaliation for the chemical attacks in Syria. Now, I got to say, I am kind of an absolutist on the whole concept of any use of weapons of mass destruction, I believe, requires a forceful response from the world community. And since the world community doesn't exist, that kind of boils down to the United States. You know, like it or not, we are the only one capable of serving as the world's policeman. You know, when the world dials 911, the phone rings at the Pentagon, all those wonderful things about it. And that doesn't mean we respond to every humanitarian crisis or every tragedy, even every mini genocide. But sometimes you have to make a point. And it's not like we can wait on the UN. You know, the UN is kind of like when Stalin was asked about the Vatican's army. He said, how many divisions does the Pope have? The UN's got none. So it's us or nobody. Do you think Trump did the right thing in at least making a retaliation against Assad?
Yeah, I do. I agree with what you said. I think that he made the right decision. I think something like chemical weapons it's just a non-starter. There's no choice. We have to maintain the international norms on chemical weapons that we've been trying to maintain since World War I. And I think that there's a lot of people who are saying, well, listen, we don't need to act. And I think that they are sort of enjoying the comfort of the fact that we have basically prohibited chemical weapons, you know, for the last 100 years. And so it seems very distant from people. But absolutely, that's a non-starter. And I think that he made the right move.
So having done that, now what do we do? It gets very interesting because that's the easy part. You know, it's pretty easy to push the button, launch a bunch of tomahawks, make some rubble, which then can't make trouble. But the guy who owns the rest of Syria, okay, he's missing a few of his toys, but he's still in power. And it looks dangerously possible that the Russians either knew about this and did nothing or may have even been complicit. So we've got a bigger problem with what happens next in Syria. Do you think there's going to be any interesting talks with Secretary of State Tillerson in Russia this week?
Yeah, I think those talks are going to be much more interesting than they were going to be this time last week. I think it sort of remains to be seen what's going to happen on both fronts. I think in terms of Syria, we need to wait and see, is Assad going to take this as a hint of, okay, I can't go there anymore. That remains to be seen. It's not clear. And in terms of Russia, I think Tillerson is heading to Russia, is in Russia, at least with sort of in a better bargaining position than he was before the strikes. Now, he can say, listen, we're serious, we mean business. And I think there's some indications that maybe Russia wasn't too pleased with what Syria did, and maybe it's blustering on the outside in order to sort of save face. The hope would be that they will back down behind the scenes, but again, that remains to be seen.
And, you know, there's been talk. Tillerson said that we need to do something. You know, there's been talk potentially about regime change being the policy for Syria. I think at some level that requires, if not assent, probably even more so assistance from Putin. Is it possible that we could say, okay, here's the deal. Assad is so bad, so tainted, such a disgusting, uncivilized human being. He's got to go. But you guys can pick a new tyrant. You know, you can pick a new puppet. Because Russia's not going to give up its warm water port. They're not going to give up the leverage that essentially running, you know, Syria as a puppet regime gives them. Can we let them pick the new bad guy?
Well, I think you're absolutely right that they're not going to agree to just completely bowing out. And I think we are going to have to press for Russian assistance if we want to have any kind of a peaceful transfer of power, although I could hardly call it, you know, call it peaceful. Whether or not they'll cooperate, my guess is that they are going to probably insist on some kind of a waiting period, some kind of a face-saving period, and that they will then eventually agree to help with it. Whether or not they choose somebody that's good, that's the tough one to say.
Let's back the lens up a little bit. I have a cunning plan for the region, and I outlined it in the opening segment of the show tonight. And I'm going to lay it on you and help me pick it apart because I have no belief that any of this is easy. But I think we're operating in Iraq and Syria from a fundamental mistake, which was created when the artificial lines on the map that created Iraq and Syria in the post-colonial era were drawn. There are no actual reasons why Iraq and Syria have the borders they do. It has nothing to do with the people there. It has nothing to do with their self-determination. Especially in Iraq, you've got Kurds and Sunni and Shia, none of whom get along particularly well, all drawn inside one border because that was easier when we were breaking up the colonial empires. In Syria, you've got an Alawite minority led by Assad. You've got a large Sunni population. You've got a bunch of other minorities. And that Sunni population essentially crosses the border into Iraq, and that is where ISIS now runs their caliphate. So ISIS erased the border between Iraq and Syria in any meaningful way during their reign of terror. So my idea, and I'm not saying there is any way to implement this easily, is let's give self-determination to the groups. Let's have a Shia Iraq in the Shia areas. Let's take the Sunni in Iraq and Syria and let them have a tribal council and some sort of self-determination. The Kurds already have a state in Iraq. Let's formally recognize it. And then let's minimize the rule of Assad or his follow-on chosen dictator and have another Syria that doesn't include the minorities that they're oppressing. Am I crazy?
No, you're not crazy, although you're right in terms of how to implement that. I think what your plan and what your idea draws to the forefront, which is incredibly important, is specifically the Sunni problem. And it's mainly been talked about in Iraq. But as you pointed out, it's a huge problem in Syria as well, because the Alawite minority is in control and the Sunni majority is not. And so this brings up sort of the failing post-surge. The surge in 2007 was successful because it identified that the Sunni population in Iraq had to have some sense of security, that they were going to be a part of the political process moving forward. And when Obama came to the presidency and said, well, we're withdrawing, we're going to get out of here, we're not following through with all this, it crumbled and left this vacuum for ISIS to come and say, like, hey, you're nobody cares about you, we care about you, right? And so what your plan highlights, which is incredibly important, is that if the Sunni population doesn't feel safe and secure and like they're part of the process, there will never be stability in that region.
And maybe it's a baby steps. Maybe we do. The Kurds got a semi-autonomous region, and they've done quite well with that. The problem is the Sunni don't have natural resources. Oil makes everything easier. Right now, the Kurds have an oil deal with the Turks, and consequently, they can kind of thumb their nose at the Baghdad government. The Sunni have some farmland, but not really a self-sustaining in a meaningful way ability to have a nation state. So maybe there's a need to make them autonomous, give them some foreign aid, develop something that at least puts them on the path to self-determination. But I just don't know why we would continue to push a failed pair of nation states that nobody's happy with.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult situation. And when you add in there that Iran is sort of like whispering in the ear of the Iraqi government, saying you've got to make sure that the Sunnis don't rise up, it just creates this toxic mess.
Yeah, I don't know that they're just whispering. I think they're sitting at the table. Yeah. In many cases, the Iraqi or the Iranian Revolutionary Guards are leading the charge through the Sunni regions in Iraq. And then you've got the Iranian-backed Shia militias who are following on the regular forces and looting and pillaging and slaughtering Sunni civilians. So I don't know how you manage to say, even if you push ISIS out, how is the Baghdad government, and which is Shia and dominated and Iranian dominated, going to rule that region once ISIS is gone?
Right, and that's a big part of the problem, is that it was our backing away from Iraq and saying, well, we don't want to be involved anymore, that it left this window for Iran to come in and, like you said, not just whisper, but basically be at the table.
Well, they haven't done anybody any favors, and I think now that Obama's gone, at least we can know that we don't have to treat the Iranians as an ally. They never have been, and they never will be. And so, Megan Opria, senior contributor at The Federalist, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure talking with you. Up next, we'll be talking with Kevin Freeman. This is Jim Hansen, and you are listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.